Physics World.
Hello, thanks for joining us today for another episode of Physics World Weekly. Coming up, we've got a special interview with a couple of scientists who are strong advocates for diversity in physics. And as you'll find out, Jess Wade and Suzanne Klein are also strong advocates of carving out diverse and interesting careers for themselves, as they both manage to combine their passion for science with a range of other activities, including art, working in industry, and outreach. Also later in the episode, you'll hear from Physics World's editor, Mateen Durrani. He's looking pretty fresh considering he got in late last night from the annual Institute of Physics awards dinner. He'll tell us all about the night, including details of who scooped the big prizes on the evening. First though, I'm joined by Physics World general physics editor, Hamish Johnston.
Hi James.
Hamish is going to tell us all about what's new on the website this week.
Well, we've got an analysis piece by Tammy Freeman. Tammy's Physics World's medical physics expert. And her piece is called Gender Equality: How Does Medical Physics Shape Up? Now, this is a report of a recent meeting that Tammy went to. The meeting was organized by the Institute of Physics Medical Physics Group and also the Institute's Women in Physics Group. Now, the meeting examined issues such as what medical physics is getting right, and one of those things is that about 40% of medical physicists are women, where medical physics could improve further in terms of gender, and how to improve gender equality throughout physics as a whole.
Okay, so how about anything within the energy and environmental sphere?
That's right. We do have something, and it's written by Dave Elliott, who is an emeritus professor of technology policy at the UK's Open University. Now, Dave writes a regular column for Physics World, and his latest column, which I have to say has been very, very popular with readers, is called 100% Renewable Electricity is Viable. And in this column, he takes on the view that it is not practical to make the shift to an electricity system that is run completely on renewable sources, such as solar and wind.
Okay, and then any other research highlights?
Yes, staying on the green energy theme, we have an article about a new aeroplane that has taken flight without the need for combustion or a propeller. Now, this was created by researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and the aircraft is propelled by something called ionic wind, which sounds really interesting, doesn't it? So to make ionic wind, you ionize air molecules and then accelerate them using an electric field. The ions collide with other air molecules, and that creates the wind that drives the airplane. I suppose it's much like a rocket engine. Their prototype aircraft was made of lightweight materials such as balsa wood and carbon fibers. I think it had a wingspan of maybe 5 or 6 meters, and it managed to fly over 45 meters indoors, propelled by this ionic wind. And you can read more about that in Combustionless Propellerless Aeroplane Takes Flight.
So it is sort of on a scale where it almost could be used by somebody then to actually get in the plane. Is that the ultimate goal then? It's going to be a light aircraft, do you think?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think maybe a drone perhaps could be the first application of this. But, you know, this is very interesting. Electric planes, I think, you know, a few years ago, that's something that people would say would never fly. But, you know, it looks like researchers are coming up with new and interesting ways to propel planes without using fossil fuels.
Well, yeah, we know how large their contribution is to greenhouse gas emissions. So yeah, it would be really important breakthrough. So how about anything in astronomy research?
Yeah, this is an interesting piece that I'm going to highlight. It's an article that I wrote. It's called Dust Collisions on Earth Could Shed Light on Planet Formation. And this was a study that was done by physicists in Germany and Japan. What they've done is they've dropped projectiles such as glass beads into clouds of dust. And they've sort of filmed this collision process using high-speed cameras. And by doing that, they were able to measure how much energy is transferred during such collisions. And they found that the collisions are described by universal scaling laws, and these laws applied regardless of the type of dust or projectile used. Now, this might sound like a strange thing to do. These sort of collisions are, exactly what happens in the dust surrounding a star while planets are being formed. And by understanding these universal scaling laws, we could gain a better understanding of planet formation.
It's quite sort of a nice classic bit of physics, isn't it? You know, classics experiment, but then bringing in some new technologies with the cameras, but then applying that to something that's obviously a huge scale. It seems like this kind of story is, cropped up over the years, hasn't it, on Physics World?
The whole study of granular materials, because these are essentially granular materials, it's fascinating. Everything from how sand piles form and then collapse. This is a really interesting sort of study that could have cosmic or astronomical implications.
Next up, we've got an interview I recorded last week when we had a special visit from Jess Wade and Suzanne Klein. Jess is an early career researcher at Imperial College London, whose research investigates polymer-based light-emitting diodes. But Jess also appears to have invented some sort of time warp device that allows her to squeeze in a huge number of activities into each day, whether it's writing features for Physics World, giving public lectures around the world, or perhaps most notably, writing a Wikipedia article a day about underrepresented scientists and engineers. Suzanne Klein has also led a fascinating career. This year, she started a 5-year manufacturing fellowship at the Centre for Fine Print Research. She's looking at the reinvention of old printing technologies, such as Woodbury type and Lippmann photography, using her expertise in colloidal chemistry, optics and 3D printing. But Suzanne also has a diploma in theoretical physics and a PhD in medical physics. She's also worked in industry for the past 19 years for Hewlett-Packard. Jess and Suzanne were visiting our offices to speak about some of the progress and challenges that remain when it comes to diversity and inclusion in scientific research. I caught up with them shortly after the talk. So Jess, I thought perhaps we could start with you. You'd like to say a bit about how you first got interested in physics and then why you decided to continue to pursue a career in the subject?
Sure. So I studied physics at school, obviously. I started out doing kind of maths, physics, chemistry, and also some art. And I went to art school for a bit, and I did a kind of art foundation and then went and lived in Florence and got super interested in kind of Renaissance art and perspective. And then always knew that I loved physics, and I think I just had a really, really great physics teacher. And like reflecting back on it as a grown-up, there's an awful lot of physics that they did in Renaissance Italy at the time. So they weren't ever just artists. They were kind of polymathematical, and they were, building massive domes on huge cathedrals. They were doing the metal work on the front of the cathedral doors. They were also painting. They were introducing perspective in artwork for the first time ever in all of history. So there was loads of maths and science in there too, and that probably just reinstated how much I loved physics. So I love physics, and then I started off studying it. And it was just so difficult, and I was so kind of, it was so fast, and I don't think I noticed quite how few women there were just because I was working so hard. So not difficult, oh, I can't do this, difficult, just challenging and so satisfying to be able to do it. So actually I just, I really enjoyed my physics degree, and it made me think I could probably do this for research. And I got into a really, really nice research group. I definitely probably chose it over the people, the people that I met, and I met in this kind of material science experimental community were all really great. And I decided to stay mainly because I've had really, really great supporters who've put me forward for things or looked after me and suggested I apply for something. So I've definitely been really lucky in that aspect, and also in choosing an area of science where I find it incredibly interesting. I think the experiments we do are really cool, and I think the applications of it are kind of quite fantastic. So I feel like every single day is a new inspiring question and challenge. So it started off as like maybe physics, and now it's like actually this is the thing that I get excited about when I wake up.
Fantastic. Yeah. And how about you, Susan? I know you've had a very varied background as well, doing this art science crossover as well in terms of imaging and different types of research. So do you have you know, a common approach to all the different types of research you do, or is it always very, very different?
It is the same and different at the same time. So I started physics by accident, basically. So I did physics, maths and German in school for my A-levels, and then everyone expected me to do German literature and creative writing. And when I registered, so the system in Germany is different, when I registered for the university, I was in the office and I thought, yeah, I can do writing. Physics is perhaps more fun. And I registered for physics. So I came home, told my mom, and she said, how could you do that to your father? Because everyone was expecting me to go down sort of the creative writing artistic route.
Is that because that was their background, or they expected my you
mom,
because you were female?
Yeah, my mom was an artist and trained artist. My father was a barrister with a strong leaning towards art. So that was basically their thought. I was made for art. Yeah, and then I started physics. I did my first degree in theoretical physics, which was okay. But I tend to get into fights with people. And then I decided not to go on with a PhD in theoretical physics. I changed to medical physics, and I quite liked it because I quite liked it that the physics had a direct impact on human lives. I worked in cancer therapy, so I wrote theoretical programs, how to simulate the interaction of heart photons with the human body. But then I got into another fight and I decided I can't stand the hierarchy in the German medical system. And during all the time, I had always contracts with German Telecom to work on optical telecommunications. And they offered me a job in Frankfurt as a research fellow. I took it. During a conference, I met here Sir Michael Barry from Bristol, and he said, why don't you come to England for a year? I thought, oh, could be nice, could be nice. And I arrived here in Bristol as a Royal Society research fellow. He said to me, you know what, that's not really for a year only, it's at least 3 years. And I thought, you could have told me earlier.
so you thought you were just coming for 1 year. You were.
Yes. I thought. And then I met my first husband, and the first child came overnight. How it happens. And then I needed more money. Mm-hmm. And Hewlett Packard had this job advert, and basically nothing was right except the word optics appeared in it. And I talked myself into the job, and then I stayed for 19 years and did many different projects. And I have to say, I created my own job. I was never ever told what I should do, so which is a nice feeling to be so free. Yeah, and when they closed Hewlett Packard Labs, I applied for the EPSSC Manufacturing Fellowship, and I got it. And I'm the first woman ever who got it. And it's for the first time given to arts faculty and not to engineering or physics faculty. And that's now research into 19th century printing technologies, how they can be translated into 21st disruptive technology. And it's real fun.
So, I mean, you both mentioned different people along the way there who've kind of advised you. I mean, who would you say has helped you at different points in your career? Perhaps Jess, I mean, are there any key sort of two or three individuals that have really helped you to get to where you are today?
First one, probably, as with most young people, is their mother. So my mum is an academic psychiatrist and also a kind of clinical psychiatrist. And certainly when I was growing up, I don't think I was aware at the time quite how inspirational and important that was for me, for both kind of developing this work ethic that actually you have to be doing something that not only do you love, but also contributes to society, but also just, you know, women can go out and do a job and be just as successful, if not more so, than their husband. And I was in she was at UCL when I was growing up, and I was in the day nursery there from, you know, 3 months old. And I don't think I've realized now until I'm a grown up how lucky I was to have that. So that was really important. My first physics teacher at school was a physicist called Dorothy Walgate, and she was actually, I found out recently, also a material scientist. So she did her PhD at Oxford, and I always, actually, I think she did her PhD at Cambridge. I have to check that. So you can keep both things and then change it. And I think at the time, I just always thought, hey, that's pretty cool. Like, it's pretty cool that she's my physics teacher, but certainly she could answer questions way beyond the actual curriculum. So kept us all in that classroom inspired, whether we were going to go on to have a career in physics or not. She knew how to talk about science in a way that was really, really exciting and I'd never experienced before. So there were two people. And then I had, when I had my PhD viva, I had my viva, despite being a physicist, I had my viva with two chemists, which was kind of terrifying and also exciting at the same time. And one of the chemists is the director of the Organic Material Innovation Center at Manchester. He's called Mike Turner. And he has been so supportive and encouraging of me, you know, from that viva onwards and kind of, you know, here's an opportunity, or why don't you come and do this talk, or, you know, how's the research going? And just those little things. I'm going to give one more person who's been just like that is Mark Miodovnik at UCL, who's, you know, the co-director of the Institute of Making with Zoe Laughlin. And I met him quite early on in my kind of academic career during my PhD. And he was involved with something at the Institute of Physics. And I remember thinking like, whoa, he's a celebrity. He's written this book and stuff.
It was our book of the year, I think, a few years back.
It's so important to all material scientists, you know, that book. And it's so incredible introducing you to not only materials, but how to communicate effectively as a scientist. And he has been so brilliant. Every single time there's anything, he invites me to talk, or he puts me forward for writing something, or I get involved with things at the Institute of Making and kind of, so yeah, there have been some really, really phenomenal women and men in my life who've been so supportive and encouraging of me in a career in sciences. I feel very grateful and lucky to have had that.
Fantastic. And how about you, Suzanne? You mentioned Michael Berry. Are there other people that have flagged opportunities for you or just being there to support you?
Yes, I would say, so I went to a Catholic girls only school run by nuns. And some of the nuns there were quite inspirational because they showed us what you can do. So our headmistress said once, you know, I had to choose whether I wanted to be the wife of the farmer's son next door or whether I wanted to go to university and join the convent. And she said, you know what? University was the more attractive choice. And when we asked her whether she was really religious, she said, you know what, I do my duties. And that was the end of the discussion.
Let's not talk any further, yeah.
So, and then when I went to university, I had a really good mentor, Professor Dulz, who said to me, you know what, the word no doesn't exist. You simply don't hear it. They have to be really quite forceful to tell you something doesn't work. Yeah, when I came here to the UK, Michael Berry actually helped me a lot. And then I made friends with Helen Cleason now in Leeds. And she always said, you know what, stay in physics. Mm. It's so lonely at the top. You cannot leave. So she made me apply for the EPSSC fellowship because she said, I can't afford to lose you. You need to stay somehow in science. We need to find a way. And I honestly, without her pushing me big time, I wouldn't have done it.
And she's obviously amazing, Helen Gleason, because she came to talk at Imperial. And she was giving a seminar to undergraduates, and you could just see in the audience how inspired and excited everyone was. And you know, you had this whole lecture theatre full, and then they gave out free lunch at the end, so everyone stuck around. But people stuck around for hours to just go and have the opportunity to talk to her. And even just, I think, because she was so impressive and welcoming, all these people who would otherwise be nervous about asking a question or opening up just came forward in the queue. I felt so sorry for her. She was standing there trying to eat a sandwich or whatever, and she had this queue of undergraduates
so
all wanting to go.
Inspiring.
And they kept talking about it afterwards, you know, they kept emailing around and you know, she's not only supportive for women in senior positions but also junior women who want to get into it.
I suppose in both of your research, well, I suppose your background with art and your stuff is obviously involving you mentioned bringing back, is it old techniques and then transforming them into
it's techniques which had, for example, one type was really popular and was commercially successful in the 19th century, but it was too advanced to survive. So simply to take up these old techniques and then transform them really into 21st century mm-hmm. new technologies. That's the thing, yeah.
I mean, do you think there is enough of that in research, you know, sort of looking across traditional academic boundaries and not, you know, not necessarily having to say, this is physics, this is chemistry, this is art. I mean, do you think it would be, perhaps the UK education system could be improved if we didn't have this sort of false compartmentalization of subject areas?
Yeah, I'm 100% sure it could. Mm. I think it's really hard when you're at school, especially now we've made it so restrictive. We make young people choose 3 A-levels. Mm. And if you want to have a career in the sciences or engineering, you've got to make sure that those subject choices include things like physics and maths and maybe chemistry or biology or, you know, one other quite strong scientific subject. And there you're really restricting people's ability to have that creative freedom, whether it's kind of art or music. And I think that young people therefore don't see how joined up all of these subjects are. And really it takes you to kind of get to postgraduate world where you suddenly realize that actually materials, chemistry, physics, art, anything all complements each other so much. We have this amazing course at Imperial, which is physics with music. Mm. And so some of the physics students do joint courses at the Royal College of Music, which is so great. Or, you know, there's design engineering now, which is joint with the Royal College of Art. And all of these things are kind of recognizing that we don't just need people who are really good at the kind of theoretical grounding and the, you know, the fundamental physics or mathematics behind something. We need people who have a real world outlook and also some way to express it. And I think the marriaging of the two, the coupling of the two things, being able to think creatively obviously helps your scientific practice and vice versa. I read somewhere that, you know, your Nobel Prize winning scientists are 2.5 times more likely than conventional scientists to play a musical instrument. Mm. Like there's some linking between having that freedom of creative thought and also doing brilliant science.
Absolutely. And if you could give, you know, one sort of brief message to perhaps somebody who is at school, who's considering a career in science, but, you know, is not quite sure whether it's right for them, what would you say?
Just give it a go. You never know. I mean, there are so many professions which are connected to science. You know, you don't need to stick to pure science. It has so many applications. I think just give it a go. Have fun. Give it a go.
I suppose most jobs that graduate scientists go on to do are not necessarily scientists. It's just there's so many skills, aren't there, that you can learn from a science degree.
Yeah, I think there are so many different things that you can do. Take something like physics. People go and work in finance. They work in policy. They work in video game design. They work in big engineering projects. They work in medical physics. They do so many different things. But the kind of pure scientific research is so fun that I genuinely don't believe if anyone had any understanding of what it was, I don't think they wouldn't want to do it. You know, every single day we get to do experiments that no one else has done. No one plans your timetable. You can just wake up and make it happen. You can do teaching if you want. You can work with people from all over the world. You get to travel. I think scientific research is such an incredibly exciting career. Mm. Even that alone would make me want to do physics, let alone all the other things that people want to employ you for.
Yeah, and it's good for girls because there is a surplus of men you can choose.
Okay, on that note. The university departments around the UK are now being bombarded with applications. Okay, thanks for your time today, anyway. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So thanks again to Jess and Suzanne for joining us last week. So now Hamish and I are joined by Mateen Durrani, Physics World's editor. We're recording this on Wednesday and Mateen got back into Bristol late last night, having spent a glitzy evening at a hotel in London for the IOP's annual awards dinner. How are you feeling, Mateen? What time did you roll in last night?
Well, the train left London Paddington Station at 11:30 p.m. and got back to Bristol at 1:30.
Wow. So, how are you feeling?
Well, not too bad. I had a strong coffee on the way back and a Kit Kat, so that kept me awake. I don't feel too bad, actually.
You've given up drinking as well, haven't you? So,
well, temporarily. Let's see how that goes.
Yeah. This dinner then, it's an annual event. What's the format?
Well, Paul Hardacre, who's the chief executive of the Institute of Physics, who are the publishers of Physics World, mentioned last night at the awards dinner that it was probably the 142nd or 3rd, he wasn't quite sure, no one's quite sure which number. It's basically an annual event that's been going on for a long time, and it brings together people in the physics community in Britain and Ireland and overseas to a venue, normally in London, to celebrate some of their achievements and to hand out the Institute's awards and prizes that they give every year. So there's a whole range of prizes to businesses, to teachers, to researchers. So last night's event was at the Royal Lancaster London Hotel, which is about 10 minutes walk from Paddington Station. There must have been about 300 or 400 people there, a big event. And I mentioned the different type of prizes that were awarded. And but part of the fun of those events is the people you meet serendipitously beforehand, during drinks and after dinner. And one of the people I met was someone I actually met a few weeks ago. He's research director of the National Physical Laboratory in Teddington in London, J.T. Janssen.
Oh, I've met J.T. Yeah, he must have been very excited about the kilogram, was he?
Well, that's a seamless cue into me telling you about the fact that he was in Versailles last week, which is the location for a big meeting of metrologists from around the world where they agreed to redefine the kilogram in terms of the Planck constant.
Was he one of the signatures that confirmed that?
Not him. He said to me that the person who... there were 60 countries around the world who voted to make this change to the kilogram and to other SI units. Each country had one representative. And I looked at the video, which you could watch live, which was live streamed last Friday. And each country sort of held up one by one a card saying whether they agreed with this change or not. And it was unanimous. So the person for the UK was actually someone from one of the government departments who apparently was his last day in office. So that was his big goodbye that he'd finally got these units redefined. So there were 60 countries around the world. And so I asked J.T. Janssen about what the event was like. And I said, was there a big party? And apparently there was the night before. With metrologists. I don't know what metrologist party's like, but there was one.
Did they have a cake shaped like a kilogram?
I didn't ask him about that, but he did say that he was on the BBC 6 o'clock news TV show, so he got a big audience of 6.5 million people. He was quite excited about that.
Okay, because we obviously covered it in the November issue of Physics World. Is a special issue, isn't it? Do you want to mention that?
Yeah, that's right. November issue of Physics World. Well, we knew this meeting was coming up, so we planned various articles, one of which is SI Units Get a Makeover, which is all about the plan to redefine the units. So that's been agreed now, and it'll come into force next May.
So I say that those articles have been very popular with our readers. I mean, do you have any sort of insights into why physicists are fascinated with articles about units and fundamental constants?
Well, for me, it seems obvious because... whatever branch of physics you're in, you will have come across units and you'll know what they're about. So those kind of articles will appeal to everybody across the discipline. And I think especially the kilogram, which is currently defined as a lump of metal in Paris, that seems terribly antiquated. And of course, the idea of redefining in terms of Planck's constant is quite interesting. And they'll use something that's known as a Kibble balance or Watt balance, which was designed at the National Physical Laboratory by Brian Kibble, who died a few years ago. And it's a way of relating mass to the Planck constant using some clever experiments involving balancing electromagnetic forces with weight.
I think anything to do with units or equations, people seem to have quite an emotional attachment to it. I remember a few years ago we had a poll on our Facebook page looking at asking people for their favourite equation, and I think it was the biggest response we'd ever had. And I guess it's because, you know, these units and these equations are things that you've been using ever since you started studying physics back in school, whereas some of the more perhaps abstract theories have only come later, so it's something you've been close to throughout your career.
Exactly. And going back to the awards dinner, before I forget, the other person I met before dinner was a former president of the Institute of Physics, Peter Knight, who has been a big influence on the UK's programme to apply quantum physics to new technologies. So things like quantum communications, quantum computing, quantum cryptography. And he was very excited about the investments that the UK is making in that. And I asked him about whether he was at that. There was a big event in Vienna last month that our colleague Margaret Harris went to, which was funded by the European Commission, and it's to forge a European program in quantum technology.
€1 billion, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that was, as Margaret said to us, you know, that there's a question about how much exactly was the amount of money. And I think Peter Knight was of the view, once you broke it down, it wasn't perhaps as stunning as was led to believe, because, of course, it's over 10 years and has to be divided by lots of countries. So yeah, I caught up with Peter Knight briefly before the dinner. I also asked him about Brexit, which has been
some common topic on this
common
podcast.
Topic.
So did that just ruin the evening then?
Well, he had quite a nice analogy. He thinks it's a very bad idea, like most physicists, most scientists, in fact. And he said it was like a bad dream, and he likened it a bit to Dallas, the 80s soap opera, where Bobby Ewing kind of died and then came back, and it was all a bad dream, this period that he had when he wasn't on the program. So he was likening it that, well, hopefully one day he'd wake up and it would all be sort of over, but he knows, you know, somehow we're going to have to cope with it. So that was Peter Knight. And then the awards dinner itself was a black tie event with some pretty good food, actually. I think there was sort of salmon starter, and the main course was, for meat eaters, was a nice bit of steak with a large, I can't remember, it looked like a large ravioli thing, object, and some green beans with that.
Ravioli.
It was good food, and quite impressed how people can make all those dinners at once. But
so how many people were at the awards?
I didn't count them. As I said before, I said several hundred, 300 or 400.
Yeah, yeah. I think you mentioned as well that with Jess Wade, who obviously just heard from, was also there. So was she picking up an award or anything like that?
Yeah, Jess Wade was there winning. She won an award for really her work in outreach and communication and engagement. It's actually the Daphne Jackson Medal and Prize. So I'm just reading the brochure here. It was for her internationally recognised work as an ambassador for STEM. Mm-hmm. Enhancing engagement across a wide range of demographics. So she was there. There was also a speech by the current president of the Institute of Physics, Julia Higgins, who is a physicist at Imperial College London who works in the chemical engineering department. And in August, I interviewed Julia for the 30th anniversary issue of Physics World. And that you can read that article online. And she gave a very good speech where it was great to see her there. And one thing she mentioned to me in the interview that I can't remember if we included or not was the inspiration that she had from her own physics teacher at school, and underlining the importance of having really good physics teachers. And Julia Higgins is in her 70s, and this teacher's still alive. She's in her 90s. Wow. And there was a picture flashed up on the screen of Julia with this physics teacher, and what an inspiration she was to her for her own career in physics.
In terms of the awards, are there loads of them, or is there one, you know, like the Oscars, is there one best film of the night type thing?
Well, the very most prestigious award is the Institute's Isaac Newton Medal and Prize. And that was given to Professor Paul Corkum from the University of Ottawa.
Canadian, yep. I should point out.
And he's a big shot in attosecond physics, and how you can study chemical reactions and look at electrons moving in atoms and molecules and observe, well, you know, orbits, quantum mechanical orbits.
Okay.
Most of the other awards that the Institute of Physics gives out are for physicists in Britain and Ireland. And what's also interesting is the president can also confer honorary fellowships on certain people. And Julia Higgins conferred them on three people, one of which was Sheila Rowan from the University of Glasgow, who's done some amazing work in detecting gravitational waves or contributing to the effort to detect gravitational waves. And so that was really pleasing. In fact, you know, there's quite a good proportion of women who got prizes, which is really nice to see. And obviously some of the prizes themselves are named after women. So there's the Daphne Jackson Prize that I mentioned before. There's also the Rosalind Franklin Medal and Prize. There's the Lisa Meitner Medal and Prize. So yeah, it was good to see quite a few women picking up some of the top awards.
So speaking about top scientists in the UK, the Bank of England is looking for a top scientist to put on, is it the 50-pound note? Is it 50 pounds? I think it is.
It's the 50-pound note.
Was there any talk at the awards banquet about
So is that a British scientist dead or alive to appear on that note?
No, I think you have to be dead.
You have to be dead, right.
You have to have been not alive and made contributions to UK science. Okay. So it didn't say that you had to be British, but had to contribute to UK way of life or intellectual activity or society. I know Brian Cox, and I agree with him for once, don't always, but he suggested Stephen Hawking should be a prime contender. And I kind of agree that that would be a really good way of honouring, you know, someone who's probably the most famous physicist. And
well, it sort of services to physics and beyond, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
So much more.
I mean, at the moment on the 50-pound note, you've got the Birmingham engineer James Watt and his collaborator Matthew Boulton, who commercialised steam engines and made them work. So it's a shame to lose an engineer off the note, but the Bank of England want the scientists to be on there. So people have got till the 14th of December to cast their vote online. So if you're thinking, you could support me or come up with your own person.
So was there any entertainment last night, or was it all very, very serious and worthy?
I was talking to my colleague at London, Ian Rathbone-Jones, who runs the communications team at the Institute of Physics in London, colleagues in London had organised the whole dinner and a lot of work went into it. And he'd done something different this year when Julia Higgins gave her presidential speech. He'd sourced a lot of videos and stills, so those were shown in time with the speech that she was giving, which was very good. There was a kind of light show by two people, whose names I can't remember, but it involved them coming on a darkened stage and waving batons with lights on them. And it was quite spectacular. And they could, at one point, the way they were waving the batons out spelled out the letters IOP, Institute of Physics.
It's like a light trail, so it leaves the...
Exactly.
They can move around it.
So, and at the very end, Paul Hardacres, who's the chief executive of the Institute, did a little twirl himself with his... at the very end of that, so that was quite fun.
So you mentioned Paul Hardacre there. So I understand he was at another fancy dinner. Was that last week with some pretty A-list celebrities, really?
Yeah. So our chief executive Paul Hardacre was at early this month in November at the Glitzy Awards dinner for the Breakthrough Prizes, which are a huge prize is awarded by Yuri Milner and the Breakthrough Foundation, and they've been going for a few years now. And Paul Hardacre attended, I think, because former president of the Institute of Physics, Jocelyn Bell Burnell, who helped discover pulsars, was awarded one of the Breakthrough Prizes this year for her work in discovering pulsars.
And that's $1 million, is that
right? I think $3 million, actually.
$3 million,
She's reinvesting all of that into physics, isn't she?
She's reinvesting it into grants and scholarships to help underrepresented groups, particularly women, into physics. Wow. And the money will be, it's a fantastic token of her generosity to do that. And the schemes that she'll run with that money will be administered, I think, by the Institute of Physics. So Paul and... Jocelyn were at this huge Glitzy Awards dinner, where, and I emailed Paul. I said, because I saw the video of the event and I noticed that Lionel Richie was singing along at, we didn't have Lionel Richie last night, but the Breakthrough Prize, you had Lionel Richie singing
"Hello,
Say You, Say Me" and various other.
Well, so was Paul dancing on the ceiling by the end of the evening?
But it was. I said to him, you know, it must be weird because you had Piers Brosnan hosting the event, Lionel Richie, and Paul dropped me an email. I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, that afterwards there was a little dinner where he was invited with Jocelyn and Yuri Milner, Sergey Brin, who founded Google, and Facebook head Mark Zuckerberg. We were in a dinner together.
I hope he didn't pick up the bill.
So I hope he doesn't mind me saying that. I don't know what they discussed, but... anyway, last night's dinner, obviously not quite on that lavish scale that the Breakthrough Prizes, but a very enjoyable event and a real feel-good factor about the strength of physics in UK and Ireland. And there was a big international contingent as well that were obviously warmly welcomed to the event as well.
Okay, so that'll be happening again. Is it same place, same time next year, or does it move around?
I don't know where it'll be next year, but it's normally in November time, yeah.
Okay, well, thanks, Mateen, for sharing all that with us. And that's all we have time for today, unfortunately. So don't forget, you can find out how to access that November issue of Physics World that Mateen was talking about by visiting our website. And there you'll also find all the news articles that Hamish mentioned at the start of the podcast. As always, don't forget to give us your feedback on any of the issues discussed today. And the best place for that is probably Twitter. Look out for our handle, @PhysicsWorld. Otherwise, join us again next week. Bye.
Physics World.